This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Hannah Kent burst onto the world lit stage and most definitely my lit idol list in 2013 with the publication of her first novel, Burial Rites. It went on to be translated in over 30 languages, won an enormous number of prizes, and went into adaptation for film. Her second novel, The Good People, was published in 2016, shortlisted for the Walter Scott Award for Historical Fiction, among many others, and is also being adapted for film. Kent is also the co-founder of the arts and culture magazine and organisation Kill Your Darlings, and more recently has written an original feature film, Run, Rabbit, Run, which will be directed by Dana Reid of The Handmaid's Tale fame and produced by Carver and XYZ Films. Kent's latest novel is Devotion, published by Picador. She lives and works on Paramount Country near Adelaide with her wife and two children. Hannah Kent, it is such a pleasure to speak to you. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have to say it's been incredibly difficult trying to kind of whittle down a set of questions to ask you. And it's partly because I think I read every single interview you did for Burial Rites and around that time, because I started writing my historical fiction around, you know, after that. And I remember just poring over things going, okay, well, what did Hannah do? What was Hannah's approach? So I feel like I'm like, oh no, everyone knows that stuff about Hannah Kent.
Oh, that's so lovely of you. And also poor you.
No, not at all. Not at all. But it's really lovely to be able to talk to you now at this end, where you've got your amazing third book, Devotion, out. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So I want to go back first, though, to begin with the first time you ever saw your words in print. And I do know that you, among other things, always wanted to be a writer, but I want to ask you about the first time you really shared your words with others. Can you remember what that was?
Oh, my goodness. Look, to be honest, I was inflicting my words on others from a very young age. I can't actually remember the first time I sort of saw my words in print. There might have been some very young sort of student publications, but we do have video evidence of me insisting on reciting a terrible poem about many terrible poems about natural disasters to my parents and forcing them to record me doing such recitations. So, you know, there is evidence of me doing terrible writing from a very early age. I think the first really important article or the piece of writing that came out for me in the sense that I felt like a published writer was an article I wrote for Voiceworks, the literary magazine, primarily sort of focused on trying to offer that kind of platform to emerging and early career writers. And I remember it because I worked really hard on this particular article, which was a sort of a non-fiction essay on the way in which Iceland was using geothermal energy as a clean energy resource. And the reason it was so important to me was because I had spent all my savings on this little computer to do my writing on, and this was the first thing I wrote on it. Oh. And I remember when I bought the computer, I thought, this is me investing in myself creatively. And this is the point from which I take myself seriously, you know, in the sense that, you know, I believed necessarily in the importance of what I was doing, but that I took my own creative impulses seriously. And, I wrote this article on my brand new computer and sent it into Voiceworks, and it was accepted and published, and I might have even got a little bit of money for it. And I remember that was a real moment for me. That felt like, you know, my decision to spend all this money on a computer was validated.
I love that. That's incredible, because so often it takes people so long to feel validated as well. The fact that you made that choice and you made it very clearly for yourself and could articulate it seems representative of a confidence that you had that you could make this happen if you willed it so and you worked for it. Is that right?
I'm not sure that I would describe it as confidence in my ability necessarily. It was more a confidence in that writing was something that I wanted to do. It was me taking my own interests seriously and refusing to sort of diminish them or to regard them as as less than because they might not necessarily lead to a career. It was still something that I was valuing as important to me. I didn't necessarily think that it would result in publication, but I was hoping that it would at least result in me committing some of my life to writing, no matter what might happen from that point. So the fact that it resulted in publication was really exciting for me because that was obviously something I was still really interested in. But I was also really proud of the article, and I think that was as equally as important, that I invested my time and energy in writing something that meant something to me.
I love that you've mentioned VoiceWorks so early on, because I wanted to go straight into talking about Kill Your Darlings, because we talk a lot on this podcast about how to be a good industry citizen and what that might look like and how to be part of this broader community that we're part of. And it was before you hit your literary stardom that you founded Kill Your Darlings with Rebecca Stafford. And the fact that I think that it's still thriving is testament to the kind of effort that you put in to create that space as well. Can you just tell us a bit about the how and the why of Kill Your Darlings getting started?
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about Kill Your Darlings because it was such an important part of my life. I'm no longer working there, but I was there for 10 years from the very start, like you say, co-founding it with Rebecca Stafford. Basically, I was in my honours year, so it must have been 2008, I think, at university, and as part of this honours year, we were invited to do a sort of work experience. Some people I know went to the local zoo to write their newsletter. I was studying creative writing at the university. I shot my hand up for an opportunity to go work at the Australian Book Review in Melbourne, and went over there and had my time working in production week, and then ended up continuously travelling back to work initially a volunteer and then as an editorial assistant. And it was during that time that I met Rebecca, who was then a deputy editor of the ABR. And eventually she was technically my sort of overseer and boss, which I never liked to let her forget. but she would set me tasks of proofreading. And eventually, after enough time sort of passed, we fell to talking about literary magazines. And we were talking about how we really appreciated those platforms of publication which published emerging writers or previously unpublished writers alongside, you know, more well-known names. And so the writers who had less experience were able to sort of lean on the reputation of those who had spent a lot more time in the field, and that it sort of was elevating their work to the same standard and showing that just because they weren't necessarily as experienced, they were still absolutely worthwhile to read. And, you know, various other things that we liked in literary magazines and our frustrations with some of them too. And then I remember one day Beck was saying something, and I was like, oh, we should just do it. We should just make one. We should just do it. She kind of put her pen down and looked at me and said, are you serious? This is something that you know we should do? And she's like, yeah, we should do it. And I was like, yeah. And then, it was funny that you asked me when I first saw my work in print, because what I actually didn't tell you was that I was a massive nerd as a kid, still am. That probably shouldn't come as any surprise. But one of the things I did do was create my own newspaper, which I wrote by hand and published, in the sense that I ended up sending it out to a bunch of people I thought would like. But eventually I got sort of a subscriber base, and I would put all sorts of articles and stories and things in it.
Have these all been collected somewhere, Hannah?
Are there copies
of these in the archive?
I'm sure. Look, to be honest, they're not for the public's eyes, but they hold a certain place in my heart. But I told Beck that, you know, clearly I was committed, because I'd already, you know, essentially been through the rigors of publishing my own newspaper. Look, to be honest, I don't think she was that impressed. But anyway, I do remember we decided to knock off work, and we went to a local cafe, and we had a notebook, and we just scribbled down all our ideas for this magazine that we thought we should make. And we got some other people on board, such as Joe Case, who was much more experienced than we were, and sort of added that experience and know-how to our sort of naive enthusiasm. And yeah, in the following year, we sort of started, in all seriousness, in 2009. Following year, 2010, we published our first issue in print. We were a quarterly publication, publishing short stories, but a lot of nonfiction, and essays, criticism, and then that continued. And then over the years we migrated to having an online basis, then went fully online, and yeah, now it's a thriving a thriving platform for all sorts of things now, not just publication, but also many workshops and awards and all sorts.
Hannah, what do you think it, I mean, I imagine it taught you an enormous number of things, but in those early years when you were starting out, you know, how steep was that learning curve, what you were learning about publishing and about editing and about the wider kind of lit community as well?
It was vertical, that learning curve, particularly for me, I think, because, you know, I was essentially the work experience kid with ABR, whereas Joe and Rebecca had far more experience working as editors, whereas my experience was fairly limited to just my education. So, you know, not only was I learning I was acting as deputy editor, not only was I sort of flying by the seat of my pants in terms of being able to have meaningful editorial conversations with our writers and those who submitted to us, but also just the enormous administrative financial effort in terms of sort of getting something like this off the ground. So there wasn't really one aspect of, you know, creating KYD and then publishing the issues that I found most educational. I think the whole thing was just this very intense, often very stressful, often joyful experience. It was huge
for me. It's interesting you say about often stressful and often joyful, because I wanted to ask, and you know, in no means does something like doing the podcast equate to something like Kill Your Darlings, but that sense of being behind the scenes, having kind of back roads into publishers, being part of those conversations, being part of the talk, the green room talk, and those things can be incredibly joyful, as you say, but I find it can also be exhausting and tiring, and it can make one very cynical about the industry that we are part of too. Did you find yourself having to balance those kinds of moods, being kind of in a part of the industry as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I remember, you know, we were working very hard on Kill Your Darlings, and we all were doing other things at the same time. I was doing my PhD and working. Rebecca was still working as an editor. We were doing all of this in our off hours, and because there was so much work to do, so many things, because we were still so small, we hadn't been able to sort of outsource, or we didn't have the technology to support it. We were putting in all our, you know, hours on the weekends. And there came a time after a couple of years where I just realized that I was sort of burning out and had very little energy, and that it was affecting my work and my PhD and my own creative writing. And I made a decision to myself at that point to sort of set some boundaries. To this day, I don't work on weekends if I can help it. I mean, there's always sometimes other circumstances which mean I do, but as a rule, I won't, you know, answer emails and do that sort of thing. I try to keep to business hours as much as possible. And in terms of, you know, the industry and being a part of that, but also becoming really invested in that and wondering about your place within that industry, again, I think that those early years taught me that it's necessary, again, to place some boundaries and to sort of see myself and what I valued in myself as not being wholly determined by my contributions through Kill Your Darlings or as an aspiring writer. So I think perhaps those were some early lessons, but yeah, certainly things that I continue to think about, the ways in which I might call myself a writer, but there are many other aspects to who I am and many other areas of my life that I need to foster, and also about ensuring that I have enough time to, you know, to rest and to live a life and be with my family and all those other really important things.
Which one has to do to have any speck of the kind of energy that you need to then go on and write the novels that you have done? I know I want to talk a little bit about burial rights, but I know that for people who are interested, there are so many interviews and so much information on kind of the backstory to burial rights. So I'll leave people to look at that themselves. But what I want to know is about the nitty-gritty of the process. I know that it was written as part of your PhD on speculative biographies. How did you go from Hannah Kent with her finished kind of document handed in as part of your PhD to this crazy worldwide auction, 30 translations and all the rest of it? Tell us what happened there.
Well, I'd started working on the book that would become Burial Rights as part of my honours year when we had to provide a thesis. And I knew that I wanted to continue it. And so I applied for my PhD on the basis of continuing that project, which I'd already started, and was accepted. I feel like I should say front up that I haven't completed my PhD. I actually had to withdraw because of other commitments, which is a little bit disappointing.
I'm so glad. There's a whole lot of people going, oh, thank goodness, there's one thing she hasn't done.
Yeah, no, failed terrifically at that. Look, maybe one day I'll return to it, but so far that's on the
back shelf. I feel like you kind of got what you needed from that one though, Hannah, like that really served its purpose.
Look, yeah, in some ways, but also I think I feel a strong sense of loyalty to my university for being so supportive, and at the very least I should be able to submit one day. We'll see. But all that aside, I began this PhD, and I think I being the person I am and always preferring creative work to academic writing, I was living in Melbourne trying to get KYD off the ground, and on all my free days I just sat down, I set myself a task of writing 1,000 words a day just to get a draft down, just to sort of appease my supervisors, and I did that. And then I just sort of actually put it under my desk to get on with everything else I needed to do. And then at some point, one of my supervisors told me about a new creative writing unpublished manuscript award, which had started, which was the Writing Australia unpublished manuscript award, won by Lucy Trelaw the following year and then discontinued very sadly after that. But I know, it's such a shame. But and I thought, well, look, maybe if I use the deadline for that award as a motivation to do a second draft. So I went back home to Adelaide. I sat in my old bedroom, my parents' house, and I basically became a recluse and just stripped out 20,000 words of this very overwritten manuscript, wrote a bunch of new scenes, and I think submitted it with like 10 minutes to go. And then I didn't think anything else of it because it was really just motivation. It was just a deadline. I always work better under pressure, and I think my supervisor must have known that I needed a bit of a kick up the butt. And so maybe a month later, I got a phone call saying that I had won it. And this was probably the turning point in terms of my writing career. For a multitude of reasons, I received some money, which allowed me to afford a bond so I could move back out of my parents' house. And, you know, have a bit of money to write as well. It provided me with a mentorship with Geraldine Brooks, who very generously read the then manuscript and gave me such wonderful brief, but such wonderful and perceptive advice. And it also led to early interest from publishers, which I sort of didn't really know how to negotiate, and also an introduction to an agent who remains my agent, Pippa Masson at Curtis Brown.
Who is, let's just make sure that we're all clear on this, for conflict of interest, also my agent, but nothing to do with the fact that anything other than that she's just amazing.
Such a legend. But she was so lovely, and she was, I told her that I didn't know how to sort of, you know, I didn't know how to send my work out to publishers, what was the etiquette there. I knew that I wanted to incorporate Geraldine's advice. What should I do? And once she had read the manuscript and taken me on, allowed me to sort of have a bit more time to just do a few more drafts, and then she sent it out. And yeah, that's kind of how I got to the point of handing it over. So it was a lot of last minute edits, a lot of surprises. Nothing was planned. I really just thought my supervisors and my examiners and maybe my mum would read that book. So everything that came afterwards was a massive shock to the system.
I love that. One of the things that we often talk about is the idea of coping with success as much as coping with failure. And one of the things I love quoting is the interview that Charlotte Wood did with Christos Tsolkas, who talks about, you know, how destabling the success, for instance, of The Slap was, which wasn't his first book, but it was a very destabilizing moment. And I know that there was lots of kind of industry pressure and chatter about how you might deal with the pressure of producing a second book on top of already the kind of idea of second book syndrome. I was reading an interview you did for Adelaide Radio, and you said, at the end of the day, I write because I love it. And I think coming back to that place of pure enjoyment and even enjoying the difficulty of writing a second novel, that's what I had to focus on and write from that place. So how did you get to that place, Hannah? How did you come back from the high of everything that was Burial Rights going out into the world to be able to write The Good People?
It took some time. It took quite a lot of time. I think, you know, there was absolutely a high there, and I was so appreciative and so grateful with the way that readers responded to Burial Rights. It was kind of bewildering in so many ways as well. This was something that I had never I had sometimes occasionally envisaged one day publishing a novel, maybe writing, you know, throughout my life. I knew that it would always be important to me, but I'd never really entertained the idea that something like this would have happened. Actually, no, never, never to that scale. And so I didn't really know how to cope with it in so many ways. And also I didn't really know anyone who had sort of been in that position. I was friends with many writers. Most of them had published books and were successful in a myriad of different ways, but none of them had sort of had that same experience with their debut. It was very disorienting. And there was a time where I just didn't really know how do I go back to the desk? You know, even just the way in which you publicize a book like that, which has been sold, for instance, into multiple countries, the amount of travel that's required. You know, I went on like a lot of tours, both here and interstate, for that book, and that was wonderful. And I, you know, what a privilege, and something I'm still pinching myself over. But just the how do you write when you're traveling? How do you focus your energy on talking about on writing a new book when you're just endlessly talking about something that you've already done? For me, it was quite a paralyzing period of time, not only thinking, oh, how do I do this again? Like, I don't know how you do this. If I did, I'd write it down and people would be interested. I mean, I don't know. This is kind of, there was a sense of it being a fluke and needing to repeat a fluke without knowing how to do so. And I think there was also, I had spent so long talking about a finished piece of work and reading from that work that I forgot how bad my first drafts are, you know? So when I sat down and I was working on this next novel, not only was I sort of really nervous about the fact that there would probably be an audience for this book and that people would be wanting to see, you know, waiting to kind of judge it and criticize it and see if it lived up to the first, there was also kind of just the sheer disappointment, that gut-churning disappointment of writing down stuff, characters, scenes, and just thinking, oh, my God, this is dross. Mm. Because you forget. I forgot to trust in the process. It had been so long since I'd been through it. I forgot how to get back to that place of acceptance and freedom and play. Mm. And so it wasn't until I sort of gave myself that stern talking to and thought, no, you need to, the only way you're going to be able to write a second novel is if you go back to that place of joy and that place of play. And one of the first things I did after I had this little conversation with myself was play a game, which I had used to play when I was at university, writing burial rites. And that is cut out words from a newspaper and make out poems from all these different words. And just revel in language just do things for no purpose other than the pleasure of just trying to create something. And I set myself some little writing exercises. I did a lot of flow writing. I listened to a lot of music and wrote in the way that the music made me feel. And after sort of doing these exercises, I managed to sort of navigate my way back to that place where everything feels malleable and hopeful and optimistic and exciting. And once I got to that place, then I truly was able to start writing again. But it's hard. It was hard for a long time to find myself back to that place of creative origin, because I was caught up for so long in the need to talk about a finished project and to kind of navigate this really scary new world of being a published writer.
Mm. How does burial rites sit in your kind of mind and heart, I suppose, and in your creative space now? Because I can imagine there's that moment that you have with a previous book where you're like, okay, I'm ready to, like, just give me the new stuff now. I want the new stuff. I don't want to talk about that anymore. But it's such an extraordinary kind of origin story. I feel like, you know, that for you, there's no escaping that book. Have you found a place for it just to sit nicely for you?
I think I have. You know, I think it will always be an incredibly important book to me, not only because it really gave me this opportunity to continue writing, but also because it was always a personal story. It will always be a story that just gripped me and for many, many years. And it was also related to a very important part of my life. So I think I will always remain proud of it. I mean, there's been times where I've occasionally had to go back, and I never read my books once they're published because it's just an excruciating experience. But there's been times where I've had to like find a reading and flip back through it. And I'm just like, oh my God, Hannah, just like cut the adverbs. What's wrong with you? you know, I do cringe a little bit at it, but I'm really proud of it as a first novel. But yeah, it's something that I will always think of fondly. I'm not embarrassed by it in any means. And I'm very grateful for the many ways it continues to affect readers, and many people still get in touch with me about it and talk to me about their experience of reading the book and what it reminded them of. And that it's become this means to meet and speak with so many people is something which is so precious.
You've said that your first two novels, in your own words, were quite wedded to the historical archive. And your third, In Devotion, is a kind of a slight departure from such fidelity to historical truth. Can you talk a little bit about what your approach was and how it's kind of shifted and why, perhaps?
Yeah, I had quite a strict methodology in terms of writing burial, what would become burial rites. And I think the reason why I was so aware of what I was doing and the parameters with which I was operating as a researcher and as a creative writer is because that book originated as part of a PhD, where I knew that I would have to provide essentially an exegesis showing my methods and stating my reasons for doing them.
It was very, very helpful. Can I just interject and say? So that was excellent.
I was always going to apologize for.
No, don't apologize for it. It was great.
Muddling process. Well, one of the reasons, you know, one of the things that I discovered early on in doing my PhD was that I was, you know, I was very aware of the fact that I was writing about someone who not only was very well known within Iceland, a big figurehead of Icelandic history, but also that someone who lived and who was often misrepresented in her lifetime. And so I felt obliged. I felt that it was an ethical obligation to do as much research as possible, not only about the circumstances of Agnes Magnusdottir's life, but also the wider socio-cultural, political sort of environment that she existed in, to show the context for her actions. So, and I felt that if I did this, and if I stayed true to everything that I discovered that could be corroborated, and I weeding out the bias and prejudice and so on, I would be I would be doing her a service and not necessarily using her death as entertainment, not exploiting her life for the sake of just writing an exciting novel. So when I did come to write down, I guess, the speculative biography or the fictional representation of her story, I ensured that everything that was a fact of that time of her life was in the book. Anything that was unknown was still suggested by similar, by research into people who were in similar positions or something that was common to that time, trying to make it as accurate as possible. And I felt that in the end, that methodology really paid off for me, especially when the book was eventually released in Iceland, in English and then later in Icelandic. I think that I could have really offended a lot of people had I got it wrong.
What a test part of it. Like, that part is terrifying, I think, for any writers.
I was so nervous. It was sort of the final test. And I was really grateful that many people approached that book in Iceland with an open mind, but also many of them commented that they felt the research to be, you know, good. And I think were permissive then of me coming in and taking a story belonging to their history. And so it seemed very natural, discovering as I was, as I did when I was researching burial rites, the story that the good people would later be based on, that I kind of used that same methodology. You know, again, I'm dealing with women who actually lived, women who were silenced in their own lifetime, women who were already subjected to all sorts of miseries. They didn't need me coming in and sort of exploiting their lives again or continually misrepresenting them. And so again, I felt that I needed, you know, this book being set in Ireland, in order to not be offensive, in order to sort of due diligence, I spent a lot of time researching fairy lore, the oral cultures of storytelling in Ireland, the times, the places, the kinds of lives women like they would have led. And again, I felt that was necessary in order to, I don't know, ensure for a compelling story, but also to provide a different perspective and to not be offensive to you know, modern Irish people. But with Devotion, it was a bit of a different story. I knew I always wanted to shake things up for this third novel, mainly because I didn't want to become, you know, the writer who picks a murderous woman from the past and writes a subversive story about her. I could sense myself, if I continued on that path, painting myself into a corner, creatively speaking. and I had no interest in doing that. And I think the changes that I made in my approach to devotion and the things that I wanted to try, the challenges I set myself, were in many ways about coming back to that place of play, that place of difficulty in the unknown. I wanted to kind of disorient myself so that I could find my way out again and rediscover the pleasure of writing again. So, yeah, that's probably why I decided to sort of break free of the archives and to sort of push myself out into less familiar waters of just pure imagination.
Let's talk about devotion a little bit now. Can you just give us your kind of short pitch of what this story is? It's a grand love story, but I want to know how are you pitching it and defining it? There will be no spoilers in this as well.
No spoilers. I'm actually really bad at pitching this novel. I really botched it when I was pitching it to my agent, and I think it was through sheer faith alone that she agreed for me to sort of go on with it. And to this day, even though there's like a synopsis on the back cover, I'm still really bad at pitching it. But it is, Devotion is essentially the story of Hannah Nussbaum, who is, when the novel opens, is a teenage girl. She's the daughter of an old Lutheran elder. And during this time, she's living in Prussia, and these old Lutherans, this congregation, is being persecuted by the king, by the authorities, for not subscribing to the king's union church. So services have been cancelled. They're holding them in secret in the forests. And many of the elders, the people in the adult world, are trying to sort of find a means for them to practice freely. Their pastors finding opportunities for emigration, and they themselves are continually petitioning the government. But Hannah is, even though she's aware of her family's persecution, she's someone who is much more concerned with what's going on in her day to day, which is her freedoms, the freedoms she experienced as a young child, are being curtailed. She is nature's child. She has always loved being outside. She has this curious kind of synesthesia where she hears the landscape speaking to her or singing to her. But at this time, her mother is trying to push her back into the house to prepare her for the only societal role really permitted to her within this closed community, and that is to be a good wife and mother. But Hannah, not only is she resentful of the fact that she now has to be inside all the time, she's increasingly aware of her differences to her peers. She doesn't know how to be acceptable to her own family. She's always doing the wrong thing. She's not accepted by her fellow, sort of the girls her age within this community. And she's very lonely, at the same time seeking solitude. And then around this time, Thea Eichenwald, the daughter of newcomers to this small village, arrives, and they develop an immediate and deep friendship that, as the community is finally granted permission to emigrate, deepens into something much stronger.
Great. Excellent.
How did I do?
You can. Okay. No, you did really well. One of the big departures in Devotion from your previous novels is that it does eventually end up in Australia. And this is something that you haven't done before. Why did you resist doing it until now? Was it just circumstance of the stories that came to you, or was there something else a part of that, Hannah?
Partly it was circumstance, because I needed to write those previous books, but there was also active avoidance on my part. And I think the reason is because I knew if I were to write historical fiction set in Australia, it would necessarily have to be about our colonial past. And this is something that I have so many problems with, as so many of us do. We recognise it to be a very dark time, to be wrong on so many levels. And I knew that I was never going to write from the perspective of an Aboriginal character. I'm not Aboriginal myself. That's not my story to tell. That's not my space to take up. You know, that's not my place. So I knew that I would necessarily have to write showing and privileging the perspective of white oppressors, white settlers. And that was not something that I wanted to do, because I think it's very hard to write historical fiction that breaks outside of the prejudices and ideologies held at that time. And I didn't know how I could do that. I didn't know how I could set a story in historical Australia, colonial South Australia particularly, without essentially adopting a perspective that I abhor. And so this was probably what kept me back from doing that. Until I discovered a way to give expression to my deep opponents of that time and the things that went on. And so, yeah, it was something that I really wrestled with for a great amount of time, because I think whenever you write about something, even if you're questioning it, even if you're interrogating it, there's always the risk that you end up celebrating or honoring it, or just repeating a narrative that has already been so destructive to so many. And I was a little bit unsure of how I could approach a story set in that time and yet escape the racist ideologies I wasn't quite sure how I could do it. And yet at the same time, after writing The Good People, I was a little bit tired of setting books in very dark, cold places. And I wanted to celebrate that some of the landscapes that I love in this country. I really was drawn. I felt myself being drawn to the Paramount country, the Barossa. I felt myself being wanting to write about Adelaide Hills, again, Paramount country, where I grew up and where I still live. And I was sort of, you know, on one hand writing very early drafts of writing about the landscape, and on the other hand having no idea what sort of story I could set here. It was something that I really thought about a great deal and didn't know how to go about until I sort of hit on, I guess, this idea that I could step away from the archive. I think that was a big incentive as well as sort of finding that position of play and challenging myself. I thought if I give myself more creative freedom, I might come up with a creative solution, or I could take some creative risks to avoid writing essentially an accurate but unnecessary representation of colonial South Australia.
Were there any kind of practical steps that you took or advice that you would give other non-Indigenous writers who are writing about history in this place that would help them to navigate this time, you know, attempting to write about this place?
Look, to be honest, I don't necessarily even feel that I'm the right person to offer advice, because I'm just another white person advising on how to write about, yeah, you know, white invaders. I think, I can say what was important to me, and I think it was really asking myself if this was a story I needed to tell.
Yeah.
And when I found the sort of story, the kind of plot, the characters and the things that I wanted to give expression to, I did realise that this was something that that I needed to write, and that could be written in a way that avoided those problems that I was speaking of. But I was also, you know, I think it is, even though this book steps away from the archives, there's still a great deal of research in it. But with that research and the facts and the local histories and the stories that I was leaning on, there's also, I think it's important to exercise an awareness that every source, no matter how, every source is written by a human hand, every source is imbued with the prejudices or racism, or even, you know, very hidden covert racism. Every source is, you know, shows a working of privilege. And I think it's important to recognize those sources, even if you do use them. So to interrogate them a little bit more. For instance, I found quite a few documents, many letters and accounts and local histories which spoke about the interactions between the Paramank and the Prussians up here in the Adelaide Hills. But they were all written by white people. So I knew that even if I was using those stories and those accounts, there was a side that was missing. Mm. I benefited hugely from speaking with a Paramank elder, Mandy Brown, who is a writer herself and was hugely instrumental in challenging my way of thinking certain aspects of my novel. She read a draft of my work and we had some chats, not just about the book, but about a lot of other things. And I really valued getting her perspective and just hearing her talk about this place as well. It made me see it with fresh eyes. So I would always urge people to have a community consultation. You know, and that's not just limited to First Nations people. That's also, I think, if you're writing characters who belong to different communities or cultures, or whose, you know, lives differ greatly from your own, I think it's always can be hugely valuable to speak to people who do belong to those communities, and to try, inherent within that is a challenging of your own, preconceived ideas and your own prejudices. So that was something that was, I would perhaps suggest, but you know, every book is different, every story is different, and I think people, so much of what is scary about this is because you really do know that there's no pro forma, you have to find your own way. But that was how I did it.
There's a great thread of a kind of deep need for ethics and integrity in the way that you go about your research. It comes through in your books. It comes through in the way you talk about it. And your research is both impeccable in all of your books, it seems, from the reader's point of view, but also held lightly, which is what all, you know, writers are always trying to do. I wanted to ask about your actual systems for recording your research. You know, are you a Scrivener type of a woman? Are you a Liz Gilbert with her index cards in boxes? Like, how do you actually keep track of it all?
This is the question I ask every other writer because I don't know.
Damn it. I wanted you to give me the answer, Hannah.
Look, I can tell you the stuff I've tried, but I mean, I borrow other people's ideas all the time because my methods so far just seem wildly chaotic and disorganized. Look, I think I'm getting a little bit better with every novel I write. I tend to keep an online folder of what I call scaffolding. And in that, I'll have some master documents, for instance. I'll probably start creating a timeline in that. I'll have a list of characters. I'll have, you know, significant events that might not even touch on the story, but I know it's all off-page stuff, so I kind of know what's going on. I'll also, when I'm reading a source that I know will be important, I'll take electronic notes and I'll keep them for easy referral. But alongside all of this, and a bibliography, I find that really useful, both of stuff that I've already read and worked through and things that I think might be helpful. I always have a sort of a big folder of printouts. I tend to sort of work digitally predominantly, but I like analog copies for reading mainly. And I also have at least one big, thick, chaotic A4 notebook, which I post pictures in, photographs, little sentences that occur to me, ideas. I scribble things out. It's completely non-linear. It's very frustrating when I need to find something in them. But they're kind of like my working through. And I don't tend to use them too much once I sit down to write. It's more just like in that period of gestation and just when I'm trying to circle round to what it is I'm going to be doing. But they look really great once you've finished a book and you think, look at this, look, I'm a creative genius. Look at all these ideas.
Yeah, I'm thinking there's like librarians listening to this right now just salivating over the Hannah Kent archive that is going to come in one day.
Yeah, all the crappy little post-its that I stick in there or the napkins, God forbid, the cliche is true. yeah, all that sort of stuff gets stuck in a thing. And when I work, when I sit down to write, I tend to put a lot of stuff up on the wall in front of me, whether that be maps or a list of characters or, yeah, timelines often as well, because I don't write my books in a linear way. I don't plot them out actually at all. I tend to write down a very sort of emotive, feelings-based draft, which is trying to capture the sensibility or the heart of the novel.
Chronologically?
No, not at all. All over the shop. Yeah, yeah, random. First drafts for me are just a bunch of scenes. There's no cohesion. And then plotting comes through the rewriting process largely, which is really probably when the first draft comes. But I still consider the first valid, that sort of assortment of different ideas. And I mean, within that first draft is often different perspectives, different voices, different tenses. It's me just trying to find my way into it, really. But I used to use Word and just kind of do endless scrolling and have track changes always fail on me and everything crash. And then with Devotion, I used Scrivener for the first time, which I have a very, you know, basic understanding of. I haven't used it. I don't know all the tricks that you can do, but I'm trying to work my way through. And I loved it for having the chapters and the different scenes because I work in that non-linear way and I'm always like, oh, crap, what's happening earlier, and I can jump back and forth without scrolling for 10 minutes. So I'm now a big fan. I don't think I'll go back to Word.
At some point, I think we're going to have to publish for the podcast like Scrivener fans and non-Scrivener fans so everyone can just make their decision that way. That is very interesting. I remember listening to a really early interview with you where you talked about your first drafts being really, really shit, and I was still at that naive kind of stage where I was like, you know, first drafts, I can't be that bad. And I always go back to it. I'm like, remember what Hannah Kent said? They can be really, really shit and then turn out well.
It's true. It's true. They're so bad. Oh my God. I know. I end up often with about five like big, you know, binder folders filled with drafts, and I keep them out. I keep them printed out because it's important for me to look back at previous projects and be like, oh yeah, it got, you know, you had to basically have a meter worth of drafts before you got anywhere good with this.
Excellent. That would give so many people comfort.
Good.
I want to, of course, I've got 18,000 questions and not much time, but I want to ask you about this idea of Devotion as a love letter. And it is, and it's that kind of heady, swoony, big feels kind of love. As I was reading this relationship between Hannah and Taya, I was thinking, this is really hard what Hannah has done at a craft and technique level. And again, I said, there's no spoilers, but you show without telling this kind of epic, all-consuming love where you're also really deeply limited by the circumstances and the scenes and the ways in which you can put your characters together and the dialogue. And I wondered how aware you were of these limitations as you were writing and whether they in fact kind of gave you that buzz or that zing to be able to be playful and experimental, or if you found them to be really difficult to get around.
Do you mean it's predominantly because of the historical context?
Historical context, yes, and just that the way in which I suppose often love stories they have that tension or that reflection in so much pain and drama and all the rest of it, but you've done it kind of without that, which is quite extraordinary, I think.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear you say so, because I think early drafts were full of that pain and that drama, okay. Especially because this is a queer love story and set within a very religious, pious community where such a love and a relationship would not have been sanctioned or would have even been possible or recognised. And I think the reasons, look, this is not paying out any of the very fabulous historical novels that feature queer characters. There are lots now and many of them are so good. But I was really anxious in writing this book to avoid a narrative of shame or self-hatred or repression or ignorance. What I wanted, perhaps also just as a queer reader, was to have a love story which was open-eyed and celebratory and elevated that love and was completely devoid of this sense that it was less than or should be hidden. I really wanted to give it a sense of the divine, a sense that this was something timeless and eternal and soul-filled. And of course, that was quite difficult to do so, you know, with these characters initially being so constrained by their circumstances. But I mean, the beauty of fiction is that you can delve deep into inner worlds and inner feelings. So even though they're not being spoken, it was a real pleasure to show someone essentially falling in love, initially not even realizing that that is what it is, and then discovering, you know, that they are in love, that this person is just gives meaning to their life in a way that they've never experienced before. But it absolutely, wanting to avoid that idea of shame was one of the reasons why I decided to take some more creative risks in this novel so that it could, so that I didn't necessarily need to follow the plot that you might otherwise expect where there is discovery and punishment. Mm. I think I really, I wanted to try and think, is it possible to write a queer love story set in a religious community that where no one is ever punished essentially for being queer?
And in one of your interviews with Ben Hunter, I think for Booktopia, you said that you love to read people who do excellent things with language, and you mentioned Sebastian Barry and Max Porter, and I wondered what other influences or techniques might contribute to that beautiful language you use.
Oh goodness, you know, I read a lot of poetry when I'm writing because I really admire a poet's way of in so few words summoning such emotion. There's such concision and precision in poetry that I am forever trying to achieve in my prose. And so I tend to read a lot of poets. I love Caroline Duffy. I love Mary Oliver. There's many, many, many poets that I could name that I really lean on. I also, I'm trying to think of who I've been reading a lot of. There's lots of other writers too who just seem to do a great deal in not very many words. I'm a big fan of Sarah Moss, who writes these very slender novels that pack such a punch. You feel like you've been winded at the end of them. You know, I really admire her ability to do that, even though she essentially writes contemporary fiction set in contemporary times. So I think every writer who I read and I would try to take something from, even if it's just a sense that, you know, there is always new creative possibilities. And that's one of the wonders of language, is that we can have so many books and none are really that alike. You can do such vast and varied things. I always feel so stuck when people ask me for recommendations because on one hand I'm just too full of them.
I do the same thing. I should never ask because I hate that question the most. You talk about vast and varied creativity. I cannot let you go without asking you about the screenplay that you wrote, because in between novels and raising children and all the rest of your life, you have also written an original screenplay. What was that process like, and has that changed your approach to novel writing?
Yeah, it was a wonderful opportunity that presented itself. Around the time that The Good People came out, I was approached by Carver Productions, who had read my books and thought they had a visual quality and wanted to know if I ever wanted to write the screen. And actually, at university, I wanted not to be a novelist but to be a playwright. So I was really interested in jumping into a different form. I was really interested in collaborating, rather than just sitting on my own all the time writing these books. And so we had this meeting where I pitched them a whole bunch of ideas, which were really just failed short stories. And they were so polite. And at the end of it, they said, look, thank you. Let us know if you think of anything else. And I was like, oh, okay. That was a fizzer. And then as we were finishing our coffees, they asked about the next book that I was thinking of. And, you know, I was already interested in this, in the Barossa, but I was also interested at that time in the idea of, you know, inheriting memory and children talking about past lives. And we started talking about that, and they got very still and they said, would this be something you might consider turning into a film? And so over the course of some years and a lot of encouragement and patience on their behalf, I ended up writing a psychological horror film called Run Rabbit Run, which is not historical at all. It's set in a contemporary Australia, and it's a story of a fertility doctor who's daughter starts talking about her other experiences. It's a bit of a ghost story as well.
That is certainly a way not to get painted into a corner with that one. So are you involved in the ongoing production as well, Hannah, or just with the...
I think the film was all ready to go ahead, and then we've had all these lockdowns and COVID's really thrown a lot of spanners into the film industry. So, but it's fully funded and I think it's fairly ready to go. So hopefully it'll start being shot quite soon. And yeah, I think there might be just one last pass of the script. I think it's pretty well done, actually. It's been a really enjoyable process, and I think it has actually changed the way I've approached novels, because it's given me a real appreciation of how everything in cinema has symbolic value. You know, the big print, any sort of description, everything's contributing to character or to plot, even if it's, and often a lot of it is subliminal. So I think it's certainly changed the way I watch films, and I think it's given me an additional appreciation of how you can really cram as much as you can possibly into a novel and make everything relevant.
Very exciting. I have to ask another question that you probably hate. If you could give the younger Hannah, just starting out, some advice on writing, or our listeners on navigating the writing world, what's one piece of useful advice that you can give or that you've received?
That's such a hard question, mainly because I never feel like I'm in the position to offer advice. But I think the one thing which does help me and which I try to lean on, especially in moments of difficulty and self-doubt, which I grapple a great deal with, is to trust in the process. Just to keep showing up, keep doing it, keep putting words down, rewrite, and eventually you'll get there and you'll realise that you've suddenly got there. And one of the things I do is I email myself the work that I've done at the end of the day. And the reason I do this is partly as backup, but also there's a real pleasure in looking at a folder of emails and seeing those small incremental steps of progress, because I include a word count as well. And then times where you've wiped it all out, but you see, you can see day by day the small, tiny steps towards a finished project. And that can be really heartening. It can be really, soul destroying on days when you feel like you'll never get there as well. But I think it's really important to not trust those overwhelming feelings of doubt or ineptitude sometimes, and rather just think, I'll just keep showing up. I think that kind of level of persistence is what pays off more than anything in writing a book particularly.
I so needed to hear that today. Thank you, Hannah. And one last thing, can you please recommend to us a debut book, anytime, any genre?
Yeah, one of the books that I've loved this year and I'm trying to push into the hands of everyone is Permafrost by S.J. Norman, which is a collection of seven stories, ghost stories, and they are so haunting. Once you read them, I really don't think they ever leave you. It's quite uncanny. And I think S.J. Norman is just a crazy, ridiculous talent and really a writer to watch. So, yeah, Permafrost, really recommend it.
Excellent. Hannah Kent, it has been such a joy to speak to you, to get your wisdom and to kind of dive deep on the whole process for you, not just your latest wonderful book, Devotion, which I urge everyone to go out and get a copy of, although I have to admit that there's a lot of shops sold out of it right now, so people maybe should do their ordering. Thank you so much for speaking to me, Hannah.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.